Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the release of the post-9/11 torture and rendition report by the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence, which has been held up for years and is heavily redacted. John Bradshaw, the Executive Director of the National Security Network, joins us to discuss the partisan political divide in response to the report as Republicans, with the exception of Senators Lindsey Graham and John McCain, defend torture and those that perpetrated it, while Democrats and the White House defend the report and the need to make it public. We will also examine why the author of the legal justification for the Bush administration's use of torture, John Yoo, was not held to account. Then we'll speak with Dr. Stephen Miles, a professor of medicine and bioethics at the University of Minnesota Medical School and author of Oath Betrayed, America's Torture Doctors. He joins us to discuss the role of CIA doctors in monitoring and resuscitating torture victims and the key role played by two psychologists who were paid more than $81 million as contractors to carry out the program, along with a multi-year indemnification of more than $1 million. We'll also look into whether Condoleezza Rice will be held to account, since she, more than Dick Cheney, seems to have authorized and directed the torture and rendition regime. Then finally, we'll get an update on where the issue of campus rape stands following the retraction by Rolling Stone of much of their expose on gang rape by fraternities at the University of Virginia. Casey Corcoran, a program director with the children's program at Future Without Violence, who works on issues of dating violence, domestic violence, and sexual health and healthy conflict resolution, joins us. We will discuss how progress can be made since many apologists for campus rape are using the shoddy reporting by Rolling Stone as an excuse to deny the nationwide problem of sexual violence on campuses. Joining us now is John Bradshaw, who is the Executive Director of the National Security Network, who previously served as the Executive Director of the Enough Project at the Center for American Progress and as Washington Director of Physicians for Human Rights. He also worked as a Foreign Service officer serving in Venezuela, Brazil, and Burma, as well as in the State Department's East Asia and Human Rights Bureaus, and as a foreign policy advisor to Senator Paul Wellstone and to Senator Robert Torricelli, both members of the Foreign Relations Committee. Welcome to Background Briefing, John Bradshaw.
Thanks for having me.
And just to start on your work as a Foreign Service officer, what evidence is there of backlashes abroad, which was a concern, and many of the apologists for the torture program were suggesting that it was unwise to release this report because of the blowback around the world. Is there any evidence of that so far?
We haven't seen reports of that yet. It's possible there could be some blowback, but if there is blowback, it's actually a blowback against what was done to the detainees and the torture program. It's not to the report itself. It's still valuable to release the report so the American public is aware of what was done in their name during this torture program.
So how much do you think the American public is divided on this? I mean, they all, obviously, we all watch movies and television. Even in the endless diet of cop shows on television, they're always roughing up people. So I think that in general, the public thinks that this kind of rough behavior, it goes with the territory.
Well, people that are professional interrogators, whether for the FBI, the police, or other organizations, don't see it that way. In their point of view, using non-coercive techniques where you gain the trust of a detainee or a suspect and eventually get them to give you the information is much more effective than these kinds of brutal coercive techniques. So superficially, yes, in a TV show, it makes for a good plot twist to get information that way. But often you'll get bad information that way. People will tell you anything to stop the torture. And if you build a relationship, build a rapport with detainees, which is more time-consuming and challenging, but is much more effective in the long run, that's the view of professional interrogators and ones that I've talked to, and I trust their view more than that of people that write TV shows.
Well, I recall when Ali Soufan wrote the op-ed for the New York Times some time back basically making the point that he and the FBI were appalled at what they found out was going on with these contractors who the CIA had hired. His only institutional understanding of torture came from the Korean War era, from the SERE program, Survival, Evasion, Resistance, Escape, which is a training program provided for U.S. military personnel, you know, for them to resist torture if indeed they're captured by, say, the North Koreans or the Chinese.
So, right. And, of course, those the techniques that the Chinese and North Koreans would have used were not designed to get actionable intelligence. They're designed to get false confessions from people and to break them. So that the idea that you would use these techniques and then reverse engineer them, which these two psychologists that were hired by the CIA did, is absurd on its face, because it's not a way to get information. It's just a way to break people, which they did. And of course, what happened, as you mentioned, the FBI and also some elements of the Department of Defense did not want to be part of this. And so cooperation between the FBI and the Defense Department and the CIA, which would have helped build intelligence profiles, did not happen because the CIA was on their own. And when the CIA officers say, well, we were just doing what we were told, this was all legal, we were doing it as part of a program, there were plenty of FBI and the military personnel who had a sense of honor and American values that they made them say they simply would not participate in this. So it's not a case where everyone who was told to do this followed orders. Some resisted it.
Again, I'm speaking with John Bradshaw, who's the Executive Director of the National Security Network. He previously served as Executive Director of the Enough Project at the Center for American Progress and as Washington Director of Physicians for Human Rights. He also worked as a Foreign Service Officer, serving in Venezuela, Brazil, and Burma, as well as in the State Department's East Asia and Human Rights Bureaus, and as a Foreign Policy Advisor to Senators Paul Wellstone and to Senator Robert Torricelli, both members of the Foreign Relations Committee. So it seems to me, though, John Bradshaw, that where the rubber really meets the road in this whole issue is in who authorized, who tasked, who cajoled, who bullied the agency into doing this torture and rendition regime. And we all know that Vice President Cheney, shortly after 9/11, said we're going to have to work on the dark side. And we all know that he went to the CIA several times and pushed them into this. My understanding is that a part of the, I mean, this is where most of the impetus came from, and yet under our system, it seems, I don't know if it's a system, but it's certainly a tradition, under our system, it always seems that the CIA gets thrown under the bus for essentially what the executive branch has told them to do, whether this goes back, you know, to the Bay of Pigs or you know, to all the revelations from the Church Committee. We've never held Presidents Kennedy, Johnson, Reagan, all of them, for basically telling the CIA to go and work on the dark side.
Well, I think you're right to point to Vice President Cheney and his staff, such members of his staff such as David Addington. Don Rumsfeld also was a supporter of this program. And I do think they share a lot of the blame, and they forced the CIA, or they pushed the CIA to do this when they were not prepared. They had no experience doing this. They had to use the SEER program, as you mentioned. They did not have any facilities to house these detainees, and they had to do that on the fly in various countries around the world. So they were being asked to do something that they really weren't prepared to do. But they did go along with it, and then subsequently, they lied to Congress and even to the other, some people in the administration that were trying to find out what was happening. There are some memos, and it's even in the report that was released today, where they said, make sure that Colin Powell doesn't find out about this, because he will not go along with it. So the CIA is not certainly not blameless. Yes, they were pushed into this, but then they went at it with gusto, and one of their officials said, now it's time to take the gloves off. They pursued this program for a number of years, and they sought out legal justification after the fact. They did not comply with the oversight. So I think there's plenty of blame to go around, and unfortunately, no one has really been held fully accountable for this this whole sorry episode.
Well, yesterday, John Bradshaw, I spoke with Glenn Carl, who's a CIA officer who was who was tasked, sent to a black site to interrogate. He wrote a book called The Interrogator in Education. And he explained that when he was first asked to do this by the deputy director of operations, and, you know, the first thing he said to the DDO was, well, where's the finding? You know, where's the presidential authorization? And apparently the DDO had, that was the first thing that occurred to them as well. They wanted to do this legally. And what they produced as a finding was John Yoo's peculiar decision, which most legal scholars say is an abomination. So why isn't John Yoo? I don't believe the Senate Intelligence Investigators interviewed him, and I don't know why he's not being held accountable. We held all those, you know, the Mengele and those Nazi doctors accountable for their quack science. So why not quack law be held accountable?
That's an interesting phrase, quack law. I think that is what John Yoo practiced when he wrote that memo. But he is now a apparently respected professor of law at the University of Berkeley, University of California in Berkeley. He has never been held accountable. As a matter of fact, he's out writing op-eds all the time now justifying what was done. I think that sets a really bad example for our country. He really betrayed his legal training by writing memos that did not use sound legal reasoning. And he also wrote memos that were based on information that he got from the interrogators. The people running the program were feeding him back information about what level of pain seemed to be acceptable and what techniques were causing certain amounts of pain that they were already using. And then based on that information, he said, this does not seem to violate any laws. So it was a circular process that was completely dishonest.
Well, my understanding about what happened was that, it goes back to Cheney and Addington and you and all of those sort of the neocons, if you will, who wanted to build the world anew. They had this reckless and utopian idea of drive-by democracy, that you could invade a country and impose democracy on them. And they hired all these young Republican operatives in the Green Zone to bring about democracy. They fired got rid of every State Department, DOD, CIA officer who spoke Arabic, because they thought somehow if you spoke Arabic, you weren't sufficiently pro-Israel. And we had this bizarre culture that I think came from right from the top in the White House, that real men, you know, take the gloves off. And so they get rid of all of the people who actually understand Arabic, understand the Middle East, and they bring in these guys from the Latin American desk, like Rodriguez, who was in charge of the program and is still its chief defender.
I was gone from the State Department by the time George Bush came in. But I don't know how I would have survived in good conscience during that time. A lot of my colleagues who were still there had a very difficult time when all of these political operatives, young political operatives with no foreign policy experience, came in to the department. And they were doing lots of things based on their theories about spreading democracy, as you mentioned, that were not related, rooted in the real world or in any understanding of the Arabic world or the Middle East.
So it's pretty clear that the CIA if they haven't been actively involved in torture over the decades, they've certainly known a lot about it, and they've worked side by side with foreign intelligence services who do torture, whether it's in Latin America or Egypt as a prime example. My understanding is that there are some intelligence services, like the Jordanians, for example, who are far much more subtle and do more along the lines of what the FBI do, as opposed to pulling out fingernails. You know, they serve tea and cookies, you know, and get the information that way. So how do we know about this crossover here between, I mean, what's the difference in fact being in the room where a foreign service intelligence person is torturing somebody and you're with the CIA and you can say, well, I didn't do it, you know?
Right. We're not sure how much of that is going on after President Obama ended the torture program. Some of that has it's been alleged that type of behavior is going on where we're outsourcing torture. There hasn't been any definitive information on that, but it's certainly not allowable under the torture convention. Countries are obligated not only to torture in their own country as well as in foreign jurisdictions, and the Obama administration just reaffirmed that. And they are also supposed to prevent torture where they can. So if you are in a room acquiescing with in torture that's happening in front of your eyes, you're certainly not doing something to try to prevent it. So I think all of that is at least a violation of the torture convention, the UN torture convention, and it shouldn't be going on. But I don't know whether there are some cases where U.S. personnel are crossing or getting pretty close to that line.
So in terms of domestic politics, it does seem, just based upon the Republicans on the Senate Select Intelligence Committee not, you know, being cooperative or actually taking the CIA side, because you know this has been a long battle to get this report out, and only the executive summary has been released, and it's fairly heavily redacted.
Uh-huh.
Tremendous resistance has been, and the Republicans went along with that resistance. And by and large, with the exception of John McCain and Lindsey Graham, they're all basically saying, you know, they're taking the Cheney line and the Bush line. So what's your sense then of how much John McCain's credibility is helping here? Because he's somebody that was tortured, and he's basically taking the high road here and explaining, for what it's worth, if the American people are listening, that the greatest damage done by this torture regime was to our moral authority around the world, because every two-bit dictator around the world, whether it's Saddam Hussein or Mugabe or whoever, they can turn around and say, hey, you know, what are you complaining about? You know, the Americans torture, so what's your problem, you know?
It's done tremendous damage to our standing overseas, and a lot the former DNI, Dennis Blair, made that comment that our standing in the world, our ability to promote human rights around the world have been damaged tremendously. Senator McCain, to his credit, and Senator Graham, have been vocal opponents of the torture program and have called for accountability. Both of them have military service. But of course, Senator McCain undercut some of his credibility years back when he was very strong about not having any torture by the Department of Defense happening at Guantanamo. He did not, however, want to restrict the CIA in the same way as the Department of Defense, and some of this reprehensible behavior continued. It's unfortunate that more Republicans who can see the damage that this has been done by this program, who are on the Foreign Relations Committee, the Intelligence Committee, other committees, haven't spoken out. But it's become a very partisan issue, unfortunately, very politicized, and probably will only get more so if this report hadn't come out now. It would not have been released once Republicans take over control of the Senate in a few short weeks.
Well, in a way, it feels to me like there's so much, you know, it's almost cultural and psychological, the divide in this country. You know, the Republicans who are apologists for this, their argument is essentially that real men torture, and that a bunch of petty wastes and people. I think at one point Karl Rove suggested that the Democrats wanted to give therapy to people like Khalid Sheikh Mohammed. They didn't want to, you know, do the manly stuff and pull the fingernails. And it seems to me that it goes back to that sort of armchair warrior type syndrome, where if you talk to real veterans, they're really appalled by war. If you talk to CIA veterans who have seen the results of, or the lack of results from torture, and know about it, and particularly those who served in the Middle East, they're appalled by all of this. I mean, in the conversation yesterday with Glenn Carl, who was put in charge of trying to you know, interrogate, enhanced interrogation of a so-called high-value al-Qaeda guy who was supposed to be like number three in the organization. From day one, they knew Glenn said the guy was clearly innocent. And yet every time he would complain to Langley that we're wasting our time here, they would say, well, he's tricking you. You've got to enhance the interrogation. So to my mind, you know, I wish that there was a way that we could separate the men from the boys here.
Well, these hardline posturers, who a lot of the neocons who are very pro-torture, It's interesting that, as you say, some of the military people and other people who have worked in this field are very much against this. Major General Paul Eaton, who's an advisor to us here at the National Security Network, who was in charge of training Iraqi forces some years back, he's very adamantly opposed to this and thinks it's a stain on our national honor and needs to be addressed. And there are many, he's part of a large group of former military officials who have spoken out against it. When you talk about the popularity and most Americans maybe wanting to turn a blind eye to this, it's interesting that there are some conservatives who are who were not as upset by the torture as they were by what the CIA did here as a rogue organization, going beyond their authority, lying to the White House, lying to the Congress, investigating or even spying on the Senate Intelligence Committee staff. So the people that are worried about an out-of-control government and big government getting too involved in things, also, many of them are conservatives or even Tea Partiers, are not thrilled to see the CIA acting in this manner. So it's not so much that those people are against torture, but they understand that you have to have some constraint, you have to have some accountability for agencies like the CIA or other agencies of the U.S. government, or they will easily go out of control. And we've seen it happen with the CIA several times, and then they have to be reined back in.
Well, John Bradshaw, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Thanks for having me.
Again, I've been speaking with John Bradshaw, who's the Executive Director of the National Security Network, who previously served as Executive Director of the Enough Project at the Center for American Progress and as Washington Director of Physicians for Human Rights. He also worked as a Foreign Service Officer, serving in Venezuela, Brazil, and Burma, as well as in the State Department's East Asia and Human Rights Bureaus, and as a Foreign Policy Advisor to Senator Paul Wellstone and to Senator Robert Torricelli, both members of the Foreign Relations Committee. We're going to take a brief station break and we're back talking about America's torture doctors.
We've all seen enough. Now it's time to decide the meekness of love or the power of pride. It doesn't matter if you're good or smart. God.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Dr. Stephen Miles, who's a professor of medicine and bioethics at the University of Minnesota Medical School in Minneapolis. He's on the faculty for the Center for Holocaust and Genocide Studies and served as medical director for the American Refugee Committee for 25 years, which included service as chief medical officer for 45,000 refugees on the Thai-Cambodian border and projects in Sudan, Croatia, Bosnia-Herzegovina, Indonesia, and the Thai-Burmese border. He's on the board of the Center for Victims of Torture, and his books include The Hippocratic Oath and the Ethics of Medicine and Oath Betrayed, America's Torture Doctors. Welcome to Background Briefing, Dr. Stephen Miles.
It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you for having me.
And you've been wading through this executive summary of the 6,300-page report on torture and rendition in the post-9/11 era that the Senate Intelligence Committee has just produced, and it's been held up and delayed, as you know. And it was, at some point or other, I mean, it seems it's almost a surprise that it ever saw the light of day, but it certainly is now. And what is the most shocking thing that you've read so far?
Well, there are a number of things that are interesting. First, in terms of the abuses, we already knew that the Defense Department was involved, but we've never been able to get a full picture of the CIA abuses, and this gives us a picture of the CIA abuses. The abuses were terrible. They went far beyond what had been told before. It included not only threats to cut the throats of the mothers of prisoners, but confining prisoners in tiny little boxes, 2 feet by 2 feet by 2 feet square. It included suspending them for 22 hours at a time. It included undisclosed deaths. But the other thing it included that I think is important to note is that there was an entire propaganda system that was aimed at the American public and at the American Congress to hide this program. There were selective leaks. There were flat-out lies. And that really the program operated as a separate propaganda system, too.
Well, we've heard of, obviously, the military-industrial complex that President Eisenhower warned about in his farewell address, and people have also talked about the terrorist-industrial complex that came up after 9/11 with all of these contractors, and now people are talking about the, or that at least the ACLU's Jamil Jaffa refers to the torture-industrial complex. But what I find so extraordinary, because in combining the raid on the Treasury since 9/11 and how Dick Cheney got the CIA to work on the so-called dark side, and he should be held accountable more than anybody because he gave the orders, but that's another matter, I guess.
It looked like the executive management of the actual torture program was actually done by Condoleezza Rice in her capacity of National Security Advisor. Her name floats through the entire document as essentially authorizing individual tortures. The document really is quite vague, however, about the chain of command, and it's not believable that a $500 million program could simply be the CIA going off the rails by itself.
Well, I wanted to just to focus in on the two psychologists who their only experience was, or the only knowledge of torture was from the U.S. Air Force's Survival, Evasion, Resistance, and Escape Program, SEER, which came out of the Korean War, where they were training or preparing soldiers and airmen for possible capture by the Chinese Communists or the North Koreans. And, of course, the point about that is that it makes no sense because the North Koreans and the Chinese weren't interested in getting information. They were interested in...
That's right. Actually, the two psychologists whose role has been known before and who whose identities are revealed in this report were paid $80 million to design an interrogation program. They had never done interrogations. They had no Arab expertise. They had no cultural or historical expertise in al-Qaeda or Arab affairs. And furthermore, there was 50 years of research on interrogations which had discredited the very approach that they selected. And so it was a stupid approach from the beginning, and it was non-productive, as the Senate says. Zero intelligence was obtained by torture.
Well, but let me just read from Chapter 13 of the report. In 2006, the value of the CIA's base contract with the company formed by the psychologists with all options exercised was in excess of $180 million. The contractors received $81 million prior to the contract's termination in 2009. And in 2007, the CIA provided a multi-year indemnification agreement to protect the company and its employees from legal liability arising out of the program. The CIA has since paid out more than $1 million pursuant to the agreement.
Yeah, plus there's another $300 million of internal CIA costs on top of the money that you just listed, so that the total cost of the secret prison system and the CIA's indirect or contracted costs and internal costs is around $550 million.
So let's talk about America's torture doctors in this context and the Hippocratic Oath. Were these two psychiatrists who made whose company was given $81 million, well, actually they made more than that, I'm sure, to conduct this torture regime, were they medical doctors or just psychologists?
These were psychologists, but the CIA had an Office of Medical Services, OMS, which provided the medical support for these interrogations. That included overseeing the denial of medical care, doing resuscitations when necessary during the waterboarding, administering sham medical treatments like blowing large volumes of fluid up prisoners' rectum, a procedure that they called rectal feeding, so that there were both physicians and psychologists who were involved in this. The medical ethics of the military has been challenged by the United Nations and by the International Committee of the Red Cross. The U.S. medical profession and psychological profession has been largely silent on these abuses.
So when is there going to be some accountability? I mean, we know that the torturers and their apologists and the senior Bush people and the CIA people involved circled the wagons on this. But
I think it's interesting. After the World War II, there was a group of Nazi doctors who were tried, and then nothing happened in the way of medical accountability until 1975. Since then, we've seen an increasing number of countries around the world who have been trying doctors for torture, and we're now up to somewhere around 80, 90 doctors who have been tried. I think that the United States is coming to its day of reckoning with regard to the medical professionals, and the question is going to be whether or not we also come to a day of reckoning with regard to the government leaders who have led us down this path. We should.
Well, Dr. Stephen Miles, I've always been amazed at how much Condoleezza Rice has escaped the condemnation that many liberals direct at George W. Bush and at Dick Cheney. And she was intimately involved. In fact, she helped, in effect, the coup against Colin Powell, who was the only sensible person in that for those first 4 years, and ended up getting his job. And as you say, she's really the one who ultimately signed off on all of this torture, and yet most of the blame is going to Dick Cheney and to the CIA guy Rodriguez. So when's Condoleezza Rice going to be held accountable?
Well, I think frankly this vindicates
Dick Cheney.
Colin Powell in January 2002 wrote a memo against torture to the White House Security Council, strongly protesting torture. He said, if we go down this way, we will alienate our enemies, we will besmirch our international reputation, we'll put our own POWs in danger, and we won't get any good intelligence out of it. And that was really, that was the beginning of the end, at which point he was beginning to be shunted out of the administration. And in fact, in this Senate torture report, they talk about keeping Powell out of the loop on the developing torture program. They say, we cannot let him know because he'll go nuts if he hears what we're up to. Powell was misled by information that was obtained by torture, but Powell actually argued very strongly against torture.
So again, though, do you think that Condoleezza Rice is going to be held to account?
I think that it looks like this operation, the Defense Department torture operation was headed by Rumsfeld, and the CIA torture operation appears to have been headed by Condoleezza Rice.
So in terms of then of the popular culture, if you will, my understanding of what went down and those that apologize or justify torture are that real men torture, that somehow the people who objected to it were kind of panty waists and not real men. And there's that whole macho aspect, and you see it in all these stupid movies and the TV series 24 and every cop show, they beat the hell out of prisoners. It seems to be a part of a cultural acceptance here. And you don't get the impression that in our popular culture we understand how brain dead and stupid and counterproductive all this stuff is, and that that real men are the ones that show, compassion and common sense.
Well, all of the interrogation data, and you can go find a good review of this from the National Defense Intelligence University, is the largest recent review. shows that if you torture somebody, they are less likely to give you information. They're more likely to lie. You can't recruit them for intelligence work. You alienate the population that you're trying to work with. And furthermore, you invite retaliatory torture. And every single one of those events happened as a consequence of this misadventure with torture.
So do you think, though, that there's a way to – I mean, the fact that John McCain supports this report, and so does Lindsey Graham, but the entire Republican Party is against it, and in effect they're taking the line that this was effective and necessary, et cetera.
Right.
I'm not sure people are listening to McCain, but in general, how do you change the culture to get them more educated about this, the absurdity of these beliefs that, and let alone the idea that by losing the moral high ground, the United States has suffered enormously with its credibility around the world, and it's been the best thing that ever happened to all these horrible dictators who now say, well, you know, the Americans torture, so what are you complaining about?
Well, I think that's exactly right. Well, it's not just the individuals we harmed, but it's also the fact that by taking up the tools of torture, we destroyed the international laws that we were using to bring dictators to account. And in one completely weird thing, we were working on a dictatorship, and we told them they had to allow the ICRC, the International Red Cross, into all their prisons. Meanwhile, the CIA was operating a secret prison in that same country, and we didn't want them to go into that one. And these kinds of knotty, riddles get created when you start torturing. It's one world, and if we're going to make it better, we're going to have to abandon torture. And as to Republicans who want to ignore the data, well, they could start by working on the data on climate change and work their way up to torture, I suppose.
Well, just in closing, do you think that it was a mistake for Obama initially when he took over? He took responsibility for the disastrous economy, which was in free fall with the meltdown on Wall Street. Roosevelt refused to touch anything until he was inaugurated in that interregnum when Hoover was begging him. And I wonder if Obama made the mistake of buying into Bush's disastrous mishandling of the economy, which led to the crash, and that also by not holding him to account for torture, he bought in to the apology. And I just wonder if those were tactical mistakes on the part of Obama.
Yeah, I think for one thing, the economy was visible and the torture was not, so he dealt with the visible issue. And the problem is that he can't really unwind it right now, partly because it's his problem, but also because the only way to rebuild international law at this point would be to endorse the International Criminal Court, which we have not endorsed. And given the current situation in the House and Senate, that's not going to happen. So I think Obama has got some very limited things he can do. And one thing he can do, and which he is doing, is he's dumping prisoners out of Guantanamo, all of which have been shown now to not be a danger and to not have intelligence.
Well, Dr. Stephen Miles, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Thank you, Ian. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Again, I've been speaking with Dr. Stephen Miles, who's a professor of medicine and bioethics at the University of Minnesota Medical School in Minneapolis. He is on the faculty for the Center for Holocaust and Genocide Studies and served as medical director for the American Refugee Committee for 25 years, which has included service as chief medical officer for 45,000 refugees on the Thai-Cambodian border and projects in Sudan, Croatia, Bosnia-Herzegovina, Indonesia, and the Thai-Burmese border. He is on the board of the Center for Victims of Torture, and his books include The Hippocratic Oath and The Ethics of Medicine and Oath Betrayed, America's Torture Doctors. We're going to take a brief station break, and we're back looking into whether the shoddy reporting by Rolling Stone will be used as an excuse to deny the nationwide problem of sexual violence on campuses. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Casey Corcoran, who is the program director with the Children's Program at Futures Without Violence. Previously, he worked at the Boston Public Health Commission and as the director of the Start Strong Building Healthy Teen Relationships Initiative, and has also worked with at-risk adults and youth in Boston around issues of dating violence, domestic violence, and sexual health and healthy conflict resolution. Welcome to Background Briefing, Casey Corcoran.
Thank you for having me.
And Senators Claire McCaskill and Kirsten Gillibrand are pushing a bill in the Senate to reform how campus sexual assaults are handled. Obviously, this is in response to the Rolling Stone story that elicited a lot of outrage, and then when it was retracted, elicited even more outrage, perhaps of a different kind. Where do we stand now from the point of view of the work that you do with children and youth victims of violence?
Well, we know that we have an enormous amount of work to do. We know that this is a prevalent problem on campuses across the country. And even with the Rolling Stone story essentially being retracted, President Sullivan of the University of Virginia came out and said, this is still one of the biggest problems facing higher ed right now, and this does not change the work that we need to do. So we know that we have an enormous amount of work to do. We have an enormous amount of work to do on the policy front. We have an enormous amount of work to do to make it safe for survivors of sexual assault to come forward and report. And we have an enormous amount of work to do around creating effective prevention programming for schools so that these crimes don't happen.
Well, I would think, though, that the retraction from the Rolling Stone article and the backlash it's caused, in effect, you know, giving license to people who might well be guilty, probably is acting as a deterrent for young women to come forward in the future.
It may, and we really hope that it doesn't, because we know from our work and working with survivors across the country, and many of these survivors have led the national efforts to create changes on college campuses, such as organizations like Know Your Nine, or young women like Angie Epifano, who came forward. We want them to be able to tell their stories. And while we don't know the full story here, we do know that this problem is going on at the University of Virginia. There were other young women included in that story, and we do know what's going on in campuses across the country. So we can't let this detract from this incredibly far-reaching problem. We need to really focus on what we know, and we have data to back that up. We need to look at those data to understand the scope and scale.
Well, apparently people who know the person involved in the Rolling Stone story or one of the principal sources, Jackie, they still insist that that her story is true. There may be some details in it that are wrong, but the story is in essence true. How do we, you know, finally get some definitive, is there going to be an investigation on this, or is it just one of these things where Rolling Stone are embarrassed, they've done their retraction, they want it to go away? People who want to justify the appalling behavior of fraternity boys feel vindicated. It doesn't feel as if anybody's actually going to get to the bottom of the actual case here. Is that your sense, or do you think that there's a possibility that there can be further investigations to find out exactly the extent to which the fraternity guys are culpable and Jackie embellished her story?
Well, what I can say is that Jackie owns her own story, and it's up to her if she wants to talk about it and how she wants to talk about it moving forward. That is up to her. Rolling Stone bears a lot of responsibility for this. They didn't do their due diligence, which is a fairly obvious thing to say. And we know that when a sexual assault occurs, we know the negative effect that trauma can have on anybody, not just a college student. So whether we get to the bottom of this particular story is not as important as making sure that we continue to listen to the voices of survivors and we continue to seek to support them, not just in publicity and getting their stories out in national news, but in the real work that's going on in the ground through trauma-informed schools, through solid prevention programming, and through caring and supportive communities that they're welcomed into when they go to college.
Again, I'm speaking with Casey Corcoran, who's a program director with the children's program at Futures Without Violence. Previously, he worked at the Boston Public Health Commission as the director of the Start Strong Building Healthy Teen Relationship Initiative, and has also worked with at-risk adult and youth in the Boston area on issues surrounding dating violence, domestic violence, and sexual health and healthy conflict resolution. So, unfortunately, Casey, this has become more of a sort of a referendum on journalism as opposed to campus rape. And as a journalist, of course, it's very upsetting to see Rolling Stone make this kind of mistake and take the hit that they are taking with their credibility, because they actually do some good stuff. Matt Taibbi, one of the best reporters on Wall Street, writes for them. So by extension, everybody that does good work in journalism is getting slimed here. And that, you know, makes me, as a journalist, I'm always furious with half-baked conspiracy stories and people. You know, the role in journalism is not to take to the public airways and say what you think or what you believe, but the job is to say what you can prove. And it's a much more rigorous process. And obviously, it broke down in this case. So do you think that we are being distracted here, that this is a referendum on bad journalism as opposed to bad behavior on campuses?
Well, I think we have to acknowledge that this is a complicated issue, and that means it's a complicated issue to report on. And that means that journalists and folks like myself who are doing programming on campus and working with colleges and universities need to do our due diligence to make sure we are doing justice to this issue and to the young people who are victims of sexual assault. And I think, as you said, we can't get distracted. We have to address that there was some poor reporting done. But we also have to acknowledge, as President Sullivan did, that there is still a problem. And she acknowledges there's still a problem at the University of Virginia, and there's a problem at campuses across the country. So we can't let this distract us from a major issue. This is one story of sexual assault on college campuses. There are thousands of stories like this across the country. And we need to make sure that we are listening to those voices and hearing what's going on those campuses. And if you, you know, the University of Virginia student newspaper has run a number of articles in the past few days talking about how, with students saying that this continues to be a problem, and students saying that, what does it say that for many students who read this story, who were at the University of Virginia, they thought that this was a perfectly plausible story given their experiences there? That speaks to the need to change the culture at the University of Virginia. And we know from all the other stories we hear across the country of the need to change the culture at those college campuses.
So how much does alcohol consumption play a part in what you've been dealing with in terms of the rapes and you know, abuse of mostly young women on campuses? In the work that you've done, is there a relationship there? Because I think a lot of underage drinking goes on campuses, and particularly in fraternities, and perhaps that lowers the threshold of you know, people's ability to resist. It creates a kind of ambiguity that some young men exploit.
We know from the research that alcohol is often involved in sexual assaults. And we'd like to say that alcohol is one of the most commonly used date rape drugs. Because many of these sexual assaults are not indiscretions, they're targeted. And there's a researcher, Dr. David Lisak, that's done really critically important research talking about how many of these sexual assaults are targeted and that they're repeat offenders. So we know, as I said, that alcohol plays a role most often as a date rape drug.
So in other words, the young women go to what they think is a campus party, and they're given punch or something that's got, you know, huge quantities of alcohol. Or, I mean, how's it done in terms of date rape? We know about Rohypnol, which is obviously surreptitiously slipped into a drink, and it lowers the victim's defenses, makes them unconscious. And So explain the analogy with alcohol in fraternities as a date rape drug.
Well, some, you know, laws have upheld that somebody who is incapacitated by alcohol cannot consent to sex. Uh-huh. So it works similar to the other date rape drugs like that we've heard about. If a young woman or anyone is incapacitated by alcohol, they cannot consent to sex. Plain and simple. And young women may be plied with alcohol at these parties in hopes of them becoming intoxicated to that point. But, you know, it happens in many different ways. But what we do know is that this is an issue where in many cases young women are being targeted and alcohol is being used as a tool to commit these offenses.
And what happens, though, when young men in these fraternities, and the drinking age is by and large in most states 21, and a lot of these guys are 18, 19, 20, and they get the women over, get them drunk in order to lower their defenses. Is there because it seems to be difficult to prove rape, or at least it's a difficult journey for the victim in going through the judicial system. What about the underage alcohol issues? Are there laws about deliberately getting people drunk in order to rape them?
Well, I would imagine that would certainly be a crime, and I can't speak to the laws in every jurisdiction, but. You know, we know that young people in college are going to experiment and are going to take risks, but that does not, that's not a license for them to be assaulted. And we need to make sure that we're doing good prevention work so that when young people come into schools, when they come to college, they are indoctrinated not into a culture that is looking to victimize them, but into a culture that's safe and supportive. A place that is welcoming. They learn the positive norms of that culture. That's why it's so critically important that we have good policies and that we do really good prevention work so that when a young person enters a school, they are entering an environment that is set up to help them succeed. Because that's really, what this is about. When we look at Title IX, and a couple of years ago, we put out a document called Beyond Title IX that highlighted steps that colleges and universities could take. Title IX solidifies a young person's right to education. It is a civil right. They have a right to access education in a safe environment. So we need to do that good prevention work so that we can reduce these cases, and we need to do good upstander work and peer-to-peer work so that when college students are seeing something that doesn't look right, that they're stepping in to stop it and say something.
Well, one would think, though, Casey Cochran, that colleges themselves all have that, they're charged with that role. They're stewards of the lives of young people for a number of years. And parents, of course, in handing them over to these institutions, expect the kids to be taken care of in those fundamental ways that you just outlined. What kind of regimes exist? They're obviously not universal across the universities of this country, but what kind of regimes exist on campuses, to your knowledge, that really do serve the interests of young women if they become victims, and also are such that perhaps they prevent a lot of the behavior that we're talking about?
Well, there are many universities that have taken the critical steps to make their campuses safer, whether it be through creating trauma-informed systems so that if a young person is assaulted, that it is handled in a trauma-informed way that doesn't re-traumatize them by having them have to retell their story to multiple people. They have options of doing it confidentially or non-confidentially. And there are programs that are expanding their prevention programming outside of just a couple of hours when a freshman enters the school, that they're embedding this sort of programming and these sorts of messages all throughout the time that a young person is on campus so that it's constantly reinforced. And that means for schools to really do this well, there needs to be a collaborative approach. That means the health centers need to be talking to the administrators, need to be talking to the preceptors and RAs, need to be talking to the student groups. Everybody needs to be working together in a coordinated way so that these students can be better supported, whether it's through the prevention programming or whether it's through the services that are needed once an assault takes place and there's going to be adjudication. There needs to be a coordinated and collaborative approach, and that means we need to get people talking to each other.
Well, just in closing, Casey Corcoran, we, of course, went through the hideous Penn State scandal involving Jerry Sandusky and the storied football coach, and it became clear during that period that a lot of colleges really turn a blind eye to bad behavior because their football programs are so important to the college, both financially and in terms of its identity and prowess, if you will. Is there anything similar to that in terms of the Greek fraternity system? Do colleges want to advertise the fact that they've got fraternities where young men can go and have a wild old time and maybe not be required to have the highest academic standards? I mean, I'm just trying to figure out what you're up against here in trying to fix this problem if the problem resides with the so-called Greek system.
Well, I would say that it doesn't reside just with the Greek system. We know that this is a problem that exists in lots of arenas and that we need to take that holistic approach to it. And I think one of the most important things we can do is what we're doing right now, which is talk about it, because this is an issue that thrives on silence. And what we can't do, whether it be because of the Rolling Stone issue or because we're getting pushback from folks who are saying that this isn't as big an issue as it is, we need to make sure we keep talking about this because that's where we're going to see change. And we need to make sure schools are coming forward and talking about this issue and talking with the students on their campus so that they know the full scope and scale. We can't push this this issue away. We can't just pretend that it's not there. We need to deal with it, which we've been doing and which we need to continue to do. And I think there are schools that, while they're not going to trumpet, while we don't want them to trumpet the bad things that are going on, that we need to trumpet the good things that are going on in the colleges and universities that are taking the critical steps to make sure their campuses are safe for all young people that are on them.
Well, Casey Corcoran, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Thank you so much. Thanks for having me.
Again, I've been speaking with Casey Corcoran, who's a program director with the Children's Program at Futures Without Violence. Previously, he worked at the Boston Public Health Commission as a director of the Start Strong Building Healthy Teen Relationships Initiative, and has also worked with at-risk adults and youth in Boston around issues of dating violence, domestic violence, and sexual health and healthy conflict resolution. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can scroll down on the right-hand side to subscribe to iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.